Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. What I'm about to read is my opinion, and only my opinion, perhaps, in all the star and satellite-studded skies. I call it Terrorism, LLC. And I start with a quote by Lewis Lapham. Because God had chosen America as the construction site of the earthly paradise, America's cause was always just, and nothing was ever America's fault. Once upon a time, in a fairy tale past, the United States of America thought it was safe from the strifes of the world, isolated by oceans it fatuously believed would protect it, even after half a century of a nuclear arms race and by the development of intercontinental missiles. The U.S. assumed a Star Wars space shield would defend it from harm. And from its inviolable fortress, it exported a highly sophisticated form of terrorism, attacking countries all over the world for one purpose or another, generally from the air with bombs and missiles. The USA pioneered many of the methods of war from the air and stratosphere, and used bombs more than any other nation, especially on cities and small villages of other nations. The morning of September 11th, 2001, dramatically ended the nation's illusory immunity. The USA was finally attacked in its own homeland by suicidal commandos who made guided missiles out of American jetliners packed with passengers in a brilliantly horrid scheme of calculated devastation aimed at the cosmic citadels of American global supremacy, the aptly named World Trade Center and the Pentagon. A fourth jetliner, possibly aimed at the White House, was forced to crash short of Washington, D.C. by its captive passengers, all of whom died with their hijackers. 9/11 was instantly pronounced the worst day in American history, and was rapidly used like a bloody shirt to declare a world war against terrorism, quote unquote. Like all such days of disaster and trauma, it quickly became a myth of American unity in crises, which, if there was any veracity to the blusteringly vengeful xenophobia, it lasted barely longer than the attack itself, despite the compulsive flag waving that immediately sprouted all over the country. The country's leaders reacted to 9/11 with a violence incomparable to its cause, confusing reality with their own empirical visions. The causa belli of the George W. Bush presidency from its first days in the White House was to invade Iraq as the linchpin of a Middle Eastern oil empire. And it was fortunate to their designs they were able to use 9/11 to curtail constitutional liberties in the name of national security far more rigidly than during the World Wars and the Cold War. The sleek corporate McDisney visions for the new century millennium were dramatically and tragically revealed for the insipid fantasies they really were on 9/11. The United States was dealt a grievous blow, and Americans abruptly realized they were not safe from the real world of danger and death, despite their near success of pretending otherwise. The nation's center of gravity radically shifted, and the ensuing mass uncertainty mixed with grim anxieties would be familiar to humanity's earliest ancestors. The devastating and unprecedented attacks on 9/11 were not directed at the WTC and Pentagon, and perhaps the White House, as mere symbols of American power, but instead as the centers of the United States' political, economic, and military self-glorified exceptionalism. This was clearly the perspective of those who elaborately planned and executed the attacks. They regarded those employed in those citadels, surely the White House, as directly responsible for American imperialism around the world. The perspective of those who elaborately planned and executed the attacks regarded those employed in these centers of American omnipotence not as innocent civilians, but as personally culpable for America's imperialist policies as American soldiers, diplomats, and mega corporations. The mental images of the captive passenger-filled suicide airliners crashing into both towers of the WTC and the Pentagon remain indelible in the American psyche nearly 15 years later, once more inflamed by the slaughterous terrorist attack on Paris on Friday the 13th, and not as noticeably on Beirut the day before. The 9/11 attack on the USA was most definitely a crime against humanity and a violation of international law because it specifically targeted civilians, as did both Paris terrorist attacks this year and Beirut. Like 9/11, the Paris attacks have been a rallying cry for revenge and war, not so much Beirut or other terrorist attacks upon non-Europeans. "You're either with us or against us," President George W. Bush declared unilaterally to the rest of the world after 9/11. Those who committed the atrocity of 9/11 did not do it because they were evil, but because they perceived evil had been done to them, and they reciprocated as they were capable. A major response of Americans to 9/11 from then to the present has been that whatever we have done to others is irrelevant. All that matters is what has been done to us, which is dealt with as though it occurred in a vacuum. The U.S. government rushed in from an undeniable truth to a false conclusion, that because 3,000 or more people were killed on 9/11, it had the right to declare a world war against terrorism and retaliate with greater violence than that sustained, as well as strong arm any nation that did not sympathize or support our unilateral declaration of war. A grievous crime was committed against the United States on 9/11, but not one that was undeserved or should have been so unexpected. Americans had lived a long time in a false bubble that assumed what the U.S. did elsewhere would not, in similar measure, reach back to it. Rather than seek international justice for a criminal act, the American response was to make war and murder many more innocents without trial and certainly without justice as died on 9/11. The government claimed these deaths were by accident, not intent, which apologists insisted were much different than the planned murders of 9/11. But war is murder on a mass scale, and Americans allowed themselves to be herded into war with little resistance. 9/11 unleashed a frenzy of bellicose patriotism in the United States. Prejudice, always waiting with its intolerant leer, leaped into the dialogue much earlier. Whatever the people of the Middle East called the massive influx of Westerners into their deserts during the first Persian Gulf War in 1991, some terms that quickly became prevalent to describe the diverse types of humanity in the Arab lands were ragheads and desert niggers, which continue in usage. Post 9/11 pundits assured readers and TV watchers that rabid religious beliefs and hot-headed passions were typical Mideast traits. Propaganda machines usually erase the ambiguities of everyday life to present stark contrasts devoid of shades. Extremes overpower dialogue, us against them, good versus evil, black and white, the only acceptable tones of public conversation. The first Gulf War, which was a decade prior to 9/11, was to protect the world's oil supply, which Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein put a chokehold on by invading neighboring Kuwait, similar to the ancient Emirates or bandits who occasionally seized portions of the old Silk Road between Rome and China and had to be chased away by the armies of each or both. The purpose of the second Gulf War, nearly 2 years after 9/11, had nothing to do with terrorism. Its real purpose was to depose Hussein, who was executed, and take control of Iraq's vast oil reserves, second largest in the world, and to frame U.S. occupation around creating a democratic state in the Middle East. That hasn't worked out so well. The second Iraq war was started ostensibly to deter Saddam Hussein's use of weapons of mass destruction, but they were never found. Since WMDs didn't materialize, the purpose of the war was recast to proclaim the democratization of Iraq, which was also a dismal failure. The only real outcome of the war was renewed Sunni-Shiite schism and creation of the murderous Islamic State, Sunni, which claims responsibility for the terrorist attacks on Paris and Beirut. President George W. Bush used the second Iraq War to pursue his ill-fated Bush Doctrine that presumed without frills the divine right of the United States to attack any nation in the world for any reason, the old-fashioned way of war, such as practiced by Saddam Hussein in Kuwait and his decade-long war with Iran, the Caesars throughout the Mediterranean world, Hitler to most of Europe. Bush asserted America's cause of preemptive war as moral and just, but there really is no such thing as a just war, only defense or revenge against unjust acts of violence or aggression. A certain cause might be considered just, but no such claim can be made for the carnage that results. Virtually every community in the United States was divided over the Iraq War and despotic policies of the Bush presidency. Portraying opponents of the war as heretics and apostates and threatening to constrain them with repressive laws is not quite the freedom and human rights the war on terrorism claimed to be. Since 9/11, terrorism has become synonymous with Islamic radicalism, which is a gross untruth. Terrorism is overwhelmingly the weapon of the strong rather than the weak. When states commit terrorism, they have more resources than individuals or groups of terrorists. Terrorism is the calculated threat or use of violence to support or advance ideological or political goals. The means and scale of violence determine the success or failure of terrorism. Violence or its threat is the leading principle of power. Webster's defines terrorism as the use of terrorizing methods of governing or resisting a government. The Random House Dictionary defines terrorism as the use of violence and threats to frighten and force one's will upon another. The American Heritage Dictionary defines terrorism more partisanly. The unlawful use or threatened use of force or violence by a person or an organized group against people or property with the intention of intimidating or coercing societies or government for ideological or political reasons, which leaves out a government's use of terror to repress and intimidate its citizenry that Webster's includes, but most certainly defines this nation's founding revolutionaries. The late Iqbal Ahmed put terrorism into five general categories: state terrorism, political terrorism, criminal terrorism, pathological terrorism, political terror of the private group, which might also be considered as oppositional terrorism. Any one or two or all five can, and often do, overlap. Terrorism inherently places ideology or other abstracts, such as the eternal struggle for liberty, equality, and eradication of poverty, above human life, that of its perpetrators as well as its targeted victims. Terrorists who are willing to die, often their deaths are a prerequisite of their terror, are often noted for their contempt toward life and the living. Though the so-called higher ideal is the terrorist's usually proclaimed manifesto, terrorism in its premeditated callousness yet precludes any claim an ideology might make toward idealism or respect for human life. It can therefore be regarded indefensible, whether used or endorsed by a state or a group of individuals, no matter the integrity of their claim. Terrorism is reprehensibly anti-human, yet essentially human. Most acts considered inhuman are exclusively human. Whatever gains possibly accrued by terrorism are eroded by the inherent callousness, however bitter or desperate, of its use. Terrorism, although tactically utilized by guerrillas as well as insurgents, should not be conflated with revolutionary warfare. Guerrilla warfare is characterized as a combination of military and political methods intended to overthrow the government of a state. Terrorism, by contrast, is more often premeditated use or threat of indiscriminate violence exercised without human constraint. And those are both quotes. The United Nations itself is unable to adequately define terrorism, perhaps because many of its member nations have been created and continue to expand their influence and power through various forms of terrorism or continents of it. Ronald Reagan once called Nicaraguan terrorists his presidency bankroll to overthrow the Sandinista government as freedom fighters. The United States has increasingly become a target for terrorism. Conversely, it is a major importer of it as well, and has been since at least the advent of the Cold War, and much earlier if suppressing Filipino independence and Caribbean banana wars are to be included. As a matter of fact, the U.S. is the only nation condemned by the World Court for International Terrorism, and it vetoed a U.N. security resolution for all nations to observe international law. Both of these in response to Nicaragua's protest against United States instigation and support of the anti-Sandinista Contras, who were counter-revolutionary terrorists from the deposed Somoza regime that had been installed by the United States in the 1930s. In 1987, the UN passed a strong resolution against terrorism. The United States and Israel voted against it. Nothing in the resolution prohibits those fighting for just cause, and that's a quote, against, and again a quote, repression and colonialism. But apartheid South Africa was a U.S. ally at the time, so native insurgents fighting to free themselves of a repressive colonial and white regime were classified in the United States as terrorist forces. And we should not forget the other 9/11. September 11, 1973, when a U.S.-backed right-wing coup brutally overthrew the elected government of Chile and committed mass terrorism against Chilean citizens. Terrorism is usually depicted as the method of violence used against us, somewhat in the manner Robert Graves defined mythology as every religion but one's own. The assertion is that it is not relevant or suitable to discuss what we have done to them, but only what they have done to us. The U.S. also interprets terrorism as any form of armed struggle against regimes it arms and supports, no matter how despotic or regressive. But terrorism might also be the use of laser-guided drones piloted by desk-bound operators targeting people, places, and things from half a world away, considering so-called collateral casualties as part of their targets. Perhaps the term cowardly terrorists might more aptly be applied to drone pilots who kill and murder their victims with computer-controlled aerial robots. Big oil cartels who knowingly distorted or concealed climate change knowledge for perhaps half a century, literally endangering life on Earth for corporate profits, could realistically be considered as eco-terrorists, as well as their hired mercenary deniers, whose purpose has been to stifle clean energy research and development until possibly too late. War inevitably kills innocent people, especially in our time, when populations are the major targets, which makes war itself a major and persistent act of terrorism, which is denied as vociferously as armies deny rape. In particular, the favored concept of total war that dates back to biblical times and earlier, in which entire populations are open to annihilation, is not only the prerogative of governments and military institutions, but obviously of those who struggle against them with any means at hand, however horrible and catastrophic the results. It is often said that terrorism is the poor man's B-52. And obviously, stratospheric bombers are far out of reach of defenseless people underneath them. Fighting terrorism is a lot like stamping out fires with your feet. They spring back up again and again, their flames scattered by the stamping, but most especially from fires underground that burn over great distances and erupt in several directions. This fire has been burning for millennia in one form or another, and each time it flares, its consequences are worse than ever. So we have two warring orthodoxies who claim God and history on their side, one with an arsenal capable of atomizing the world to oblivion, the other armed with comparatively inferior weapons, yet with imaginatively destructive intentions of their use that are defined euphemistically as low-density warfare. They have shown themselves able to attack anywhere in the world with passionate fury and calculating homicidal suicide. Human civilization is on the brink of something dire and awesome. It stares into a volatile vortex that might very well obliterate it. Already the possibility of World War III is invoked, the final conflict predicted for millennia and possibly encouraged by millenarians. The embattled dictator, Bashar al-Assad of Syria, is considered at the vortex of the tectonic disturbances oscillating the Middle East since the Arab Spring 5 years ago. He has virtually reduced his regime to rubble to save it, or more precisely, himself. The mass slaughter of Syrians and resultant refugee crisis swamping Europe, the rise of ISIS in both Syria and Iraq, which feeds off the rebellion against Assad and antipathy for the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. Remove Assad and the bad juju will go away, Western analysts claim. They think that can be done with alliance between the West and Russia. But will the mass exodus to Europe reverse its flow and the scattered pieces reassemble? Or is it too late to prevent the absorption into their homelands that Europeans dread? Western involvement in the Middle East has been caustically stupid and punitively exploitive, especially the sordid French and English colonialism after World War I and post-World War II American petroleum imperialism, in particular the 1953 overthrow of Iran's elected government. Palestine, Israel, is the true focal point of the pan-Arabic vortex. It is where two very different peoples clash over ancestral land, each disputably claims indisputably, which exacerbates every other conflict in Islam and might be the real prophesied Armageddon. For the United States and Europe, Israel is the brave outpost of Judaism struggling to sustain its recaptured biblical promised land, Zion, also synonymous with heaven and Jerusalem. To the Arab peoples, it is an upstart intrusion that usurped ancient Arab lands and cultures that once tolerated Judaism, but loathes modern zealous Zionism that has disinherited them. This small splinter of Mediterranean desert between West and East has been the focal point of history since the savage anti-Semitic pogroms of Europe precipitated the Zionist movement to recreate a Jewish homeland in Palestine their ancestors had to flee in the infamous diaspora of Roman times. Except another people of another ancient religious culture were living in Palestine. And for them, it was their ancestral homeland also, and among them were Jews. These people were not isolated from the rest of humanity, as had been the indigenous American peoples, who were ultimately deprived of their lands and nearly exterminated by a three-century war of genocide. Defending the Palestinians, culturally and territorially, is the rest of Islam. This is the root of the problem that prevents a truly world civilization, which has been a long-held dream, at least for dreamers, philosophers, and humanitarians, weary of interminable wars between tribes, cultures, races, religions, and nations. Here is the seemingly unresolvable problem that threatens humanity with possible annihilation. Here, the best and worst traits of humanity are evident on both sides, and clash head on. Would a United Nations redistribution of Palestine-Israel work toward settling the problem acceptable to both East and West? Will Jews and Palestinians give up religious nationalism for the sake of sharing a dual homeland, as they continually pledge? Would a few generations eventually heal the rift that has existed for more than 1,000 years between three of the world's significant religions? Or is it hopelessly mired in the irredeemable past and thus patently self-destructs the human future? It would be a grotesque irony that humanity perishes because it is unable to resolve the conflicts from its earliest history. And that is something I wrote. And now I'd like to read a couple of letters to the New York Times. The first from Thera P. on 11/15. We all need to pause. We need a time of meditation, time to reflect and grieve over losses, particularly the loss of our common humanity, common decency, common sense. I know this sounds trite, but my concern is that too often a tragedy, a trauma, sets off a bellicose overreaction in the wrong direction. ISIS, why are we calling it by three different names? It is as if it were a hydra able to transform any attack by growing more heads. Yes, it uses fearful tactics. Yes, we all feel a sense of vulnerability when we see videos of its cruelty in meting out death to those it captures. Yes, we recoil at its brazen attacks, ever more menacing. Yes, it brainwashes its recruits, including the recruitment of wives, for its intent of breeding its own babies, future terrorists. But still, our humanity, our dignity, demands that we stand back and ponder before acting in haste, that we have a national conversation, a worldwide conversation. We need a coalition of spiritual leaders as well as non-religious persons of wisdom and good conscience, along with ordinary citizens of goodwill, to consider what combination of security measures and humanitarian measures we, as citizens of a fragile world, believe might serve the greater good, rather than just the defense industries and the haters across the globe. We need to think about ends before choosing means, ends which do not end in PTSD, in killing, in police states. Is this too much for an old lady to ask? And from Astoria, New York. I can only pray that France will do a better job than the USA did at dealing with three disturbing realities post 9/11. I hope they can resist the urge to succumb to right-wing paranoia and xenophobia, which is something we have often failed at. And that is simply signed, Buddy, Astoria, New York. I would like to finish this program with a poem by Carolyn Dunn, After Great Fear, and a quote. But again and again, this instinct of the earth, unimaginable how it expands within you, this roaring of blood or sap, we must have been trees in the beginning. And that was Greek poet George Sepharis, journal entry October 24th, 1950. Following acts of violence, we are offered, if we wish, the stillness of alder leaves, moving in concert with an easterly wind in the morning. As the wind shifts to the northeast, the leaves bend and hold, a freshness to the light. And this is the image of our lives, the alder leaves in motion, to every wind from any quarter. And that was by Carolyn Dunn, who wrote it on 9/30, September 30th, 2001. She died a couple of years ago. This has been Michael McCusker.